Welcome to Dialogue. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. The Instruments of Surrender were signed in 1945, but World War II never stopped being fought, at least in movie theaters and on television screens. The war has served as the focus or backdrop for stories told by every country that saw major involvement in the war, allies and Axis alike. This hour on Dialogue, a look at those war stories, how they're told, and what they tell us. I'm joined today by two panelists who know about this subject. Seth Paradin is an historian at the National World War II Museum. He's also the host of the museum's podcast, Service on Celluloid. He joins us from the studios of NPR member station WWNO in New Orleans. Seth, welcome.
Hey, how you doing? Thank you.
Doing very well, thank you. And joining us on the phone from Southern California is Steve Rubin. He has studied and watched his fair share of combat film and television shows. He's the author of the book, Combat Films, American Realism, 1945 to 2010. Steve, welcome.
Hello.
Well, today, as we said, we're talking about this massive genre, some 1,300 films or more. There's no comprehensive, exhaustive list that I found of films that have something to do with World War II, and only an hour in which to talk about them, so we'll jump right in. Starting with author Frank Cottrell Boyce, who once said that the huge amount of the war pictures that we're talking about today sort of create their own environment, their own atmosphere. He said, it reached a tipping point at some time. The war has become a metaphor, not just history. You can map onto it any way you want. So obviously the war is a canvas that filmmakers can use. Steve, we'll begin with you a little bit about that. Because you wrote a book on combat films, talk a little bit about how the war has these various facets, these various prisms that then people kind of hang their own narratives onto.
Well, to start with, you have the great drama of the war with clear foes. And unlike pretty much any war other than maybe the American Civil War, I mean, certainly the contemporary wars don't match that. And I think because you have drama, people are riveted, and you start from there. So every aspect involving the Germans and the Japanese and both theaters have always made compelling cinema. And I think part of the problem that there were very few movies about the Vietnam War and even fewer about some of the more recent wars is because the danger, the present danger of the enemy is not as clear and certainly not as overreaching to everyone. I mean, everyone in the United States during World War II was affected by the war on many different levels. And I think that it became a huge calamitous effort, and people have always been riveted to it, and it hasn't changed. I think to this day, and within a few days, we're going to have another big World War II movie open, this epic Midway movie. And I think that people just find it a fascinating arena to see, because they're dealing with people who are dealing with life and death situations.
All right. And Seth, anything to add to that?
No, I think that's 100% accurate. You know, like you said, World War II touched every single person in the across the world, really, but especially in the United States. It touched every aspect of their lives. And, you know, these were our grandfathers, grandmothers, fathers, you know, mothers, whoever, depending on your age and generation. But, I mean, you have some connection to the war in, you know, almost every family in the United States in some way, shape, or form. So it remains a popular subject. You know, as you said in the intro, 80 years after the war actually began. So it's still very poignant today.
And those films started to be made while the war was in progress. One count that I saw was 250 films about World War II or had some connection to World War II before the war was finished or by the time it finished. Seth, I want to talk a little bit about some of the character of those films. Like, as the war is in progress, you don't know how it's going to turn out. Some of these films were just kind of straight-out propaganda. Others were more typical kind of films like we might see today, where you're telling a comedic story or a dramatic story. What was the character of some of those initial films early on?
Well, some of the earlier films, like say, Bataan, and movies like that were made during the war, especially early in the war, and by early, I mean early for the United States, 42, 43, a lot of them were very propaganda. Well, they were propaganda. They weren't very propaganda. They were propaganda. They were trying to demonize the enemy, be it the Japanese or the Germans, and they were trying to lionize our troops. And they were also really trying to build public support. They were trying to get the American public, not that we needed much encouragement, but they were trying to get as much public support for the war effort as they possibly could. And these stories were very melodramatic, not necessarily dramatic, but very melodramatic in that, you know, there's a lot of corn in a lot of them, to be frank with you.
And I want to talk a little bit about that. So the contemporary war films we talk about, I used as an example in some of my research here, like Why We Fight, which was done by Frank Capra. And it's express purpose. It's billed as an information film. It's available on YouTube. It's a series of 7 films. If you look at it from the National Archives, the title card says a series of information films. But really the point was to bolster public support for this war during the war. Could you tell us a little bit more about that particular series?
Yeah, so Capra obviously was, you know, he was a famous director before World War II, and after he directed, you know, It's a Wonderful Life, for crying out loud, one of the greatest movies ever made, in my humble opinion. But the Why We Fight series, where he was contracted by the military to do these, and they're, if you watch them, they combine a lot of archival footage, and I call it archival. It was contemporary then, but it's archival now. That was shot by all nations. So there's British footage in there, there's Japanese footage in there, there's German footage in there, there's American footage in there. And that he's chronicling what led up to the beginning and the instances that occurred right after the beginning of World War II, mostly in Europe. He focuses on the fall of France heavily. And, you know, things that were capturing the Americans' attention in 1940 and 41, things that, you know, really grabbed our attention on the newspaper headlines and across the radio, and started to get people in the United States kind of wondering, you know, should we support the European war effort, and are we going to get involved?
Steve, I want to turn back to you for a moment. As the war closes out, an interesting attitude developed in Hollywood. There was a perception among studio heads that this was a fad. It had run its course. The war is over. The guns are silent now. So we're going to go back to making some different kind of films. Tell us a little bit about, I know it seems weird to us today because we're still making films about this war and talking about it, depicting it on television and film. But there was a time immediately after the war that many of the people who were in charge of entertainment, mass entertainment in the U.S., thought, okay, this has run its course.
Well, I think pure exhaustion probably was one of the characters there. We'd fought for 4 years. The world had been involved in the war for 6 or 7 years. I think that Hollywood, the whole country was kind of tired of war stories. I think the feeling was, I remember when A Walk in the Sun was released in early 1946, was one of the last films released in that period. It just wasn't a huge hit because people were tired. They kind of wanted to return to more lighthearted subjects. I wanted to also point out one thing earlier about the early war films. I think we had a clear and present danger with isolationism in the States before the war began, and I think that just like the Nazis, who were very, very clever filmmakers and their propaganda machine was titanic, our movie industry became an arm of the military. I think that, first of all, to educate, just like Seth said about the Why We Fight movies, because we had to educate a whole generation of young American soldiers who weren't quite sure why they were fighting. So, I mean, these movies were enormously important with the war effort. And then as the war went on, I think the war films became very much a part of the sensibility. Hard for us to think about today because it's quite a different world. You know, Hollywood is kind of an independent force in certain ways. But that period, as the war ended, I think was purely people were exhausted by things, and it was time to get back to normalcy. Little things like producing cars that were not the same cars they got in 1939.
And I think you raise an interesting point here, Steve, when you talk about we didn't know how the war was going to turn out. You're educating an entire generation of people about kind of what this looks like from, say, the 10,000, 20,000-foot view, when isolationism was not an insignificant factor in much of the 1930s and early 1940s, where people felt like, okay, that's a European thing. We went through that 20 years ago. We don't want to do this again, to sort of counter that tide, where today it seems like the fait accompli, and we talk about the greatest generation, and in part that impression was created by the films and TV series we're talking about. Is that a fair assessment?
Very much so. Also, we were woefully unprepared for World War II. I mean, we barely passed the draft. I mean, I'm just reading this book about the history of the North African campaign, and we were just not a potent military force that we certainly became, but I think we needed all the help we can get, and movies certainly brought young men into the service at a time when we desperately needed to fill out the ranks.
Well, let's go to now after the war. You mentioned Walk in the Sun, which came out in 1946. Also, 1946 was noted for the best years of our lives. I mean, this is a classic film. It is still shown on, say, Turner Classic Movies. Today is still very well regarded. It was a critical and commercial success. But it wasn't a rah-rah kind of film. It was not a heartwarming or a romantic or an adventurous kind of thing. This is a hard-to-hear story about what happens to veterans when they come back from war. We have a clip, actually, from Best Years of Our Lives. This is Harold Russell as a naval officer named Homer Parrish, who's lost both of his hands and is now using hooks, basically, as his digits at the ends of his arms. Here he is talking about what that's like.
This is when I know I'm helpless. My hands are down there on the bed. I can't put them on again without calling to somebody for help. I can't smoke a cigarette or read a book. If that door should blow shut, I can't open it and get out of this room. I'm as dependent as a baby that doesn't know how to get anything except cry for it. Well, now you know, Wilma. Now you have an idea of what it is. I guess you don't know what to say. It's all right. Go on home. Go away like your family said.
I know what to say, Homer. I love you. And I'm never going to leave you. Never.
That's kind of hard or even emotional to listen to even now, you know, after this film came out almost 75 years ago, this film. Seth, I want to begin with you on this. What makes Best Years of Our Lives so significant? Why is it such a milestone in this genre?
Well, it's incredibly important because it does show the American public, and not necessarily the GIs that are returning home, but the people that were left behind, what their servicemen are going to go through, not necessarily what they went through over there. You know, not they're not showing the combat, but they're showing the internal combat that these guys are going to be facing when they're coming home. And this was a very real thing then. And frankly, it's just as real today as it was then. You know, the people that got married in 1942, right before, you know, Johnny shipped overseas, they were different, both of them. You know, the male and the female were different people in 1945 when Johnny came marching home. It was, you know, they were either physically disabled or, you know, suffering from post-traumatic stress or both. And they were completely different people. And this movie shows that in every way, really. And it's one of the first movies that, at least that I can recall, and Steve, you might be able to comment on this, I'm sure you can, that shows a guy suffering with post-traumatic stress. It's Dana Andrews in the bed. He's sleeping and he's having nightmares. And he wakes up crying and shaking. And that, I don't recall that ever being shown on American screens, certainly not in 1946. And it showed the go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I mean, certainly during the war, this movie would have been forbidden because we could not show the trauma our soldiers were facing. On the other hand, we had to build it up that they were strong and bold and they were going to win and victorious. I mean, this is, well, first of all, the filmmaker William Wyler was probably one of the greatest filmmakers in film history. I mean, he, a sensitive filmmaker who had just gone through the trauma of the war. Mm-hmm. Chronicling it in the air war in B-17s, where he lost most of his hearing. He was dead set on getting the realism factor, and of course Memphis Belle was his great documentary. So Wyler was a very sensitive filmmaker. But the scene in Best Years of Our Lives, when Dana Andrews, now going to be divorced from his wife and kind of aimless, can't find a job, as you point out, psychologically traumatized by nightmares, he ends up just at an airport, and he starts to wander amongst acres and acres of airplanes that are about to be destroyed because the war is over. And that sequence, or he's wandering aimlessly trying to figure out what he's going, and then he takes a seat in his old bombardier seat, is just devastatingly important, and it's a strong scene. But there's also a touch of humor in that movie that I have to point out. When Frederick March is having breakfast with his wife Myrna Loy, and he's of course just returned from infantry duty in the Pacific, and his waistline is diminished, his pants are too big, and then his wife says, "Oh, you're not going to go to work right away," and he says, "Well, you've got to make money. Last year it was kill Japs. This year it's make money." I just almost fell off my chair. I mean, they added a little touch of humor, but the irony and the importance of statements like that, these men were involved in war for 2, 3, 4 years, and now they're home trying to get a job. It's pretty impressive filmmaking.
It's a beautiful film, and it's a different world that they come home to. You know, the world that they leave in 1942, 43, whenever they go overseas, is, you know, especially if they left early in the war. The United States was still ramping up their production, ramping up their military. We were coming out of the Depression. And then they come home, not that the country's, you know, uberly prosperous, but it's a heck of a lot more prosperous in 1945, 46 than it was in 41, 42. And, you know, it's a different world that they come home to. And it takes a lot of getting used to. And, you know, I mean, I knew a lot of World War II veterans, and some of them never got used to it.
All right, we'll pause here.
They didn't talk about it. And the true combat veterans, the ones who'd seen the real combat, just wouldn't talk about it because they really felt that people wouldn't understand what they were talking about, and it still hurt deeply.
I want to pause this right there. Sorry for a station break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're going to continue this interesting discussion with Seth Paradin and Steve Rubin. First, though, you're listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. Dialogue now continues. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. If you're just joining us, the topic today, World War II on the silver screen and the small screen. I'm joined by Steve Rubin, author of the book Combat Films, American Realism, 1945 to 2010, and Seth Paradin with the National World War II Museum. He's the host of the museum's podcast, Service on Celluloid. We'd like to hear from you as well. You can tweet your questions at WUOTFM on Twitter. Respond to our Facebook posts. That's facebook.com/WUOTFM. Just leave your question in the replies. Or you can call us at 974-5050. When we left off, gentlemen, before the break, we were talking about immediately following the war, starting to explore looking then at the effects of the war, telling the story not contemporaneously, but now looking back on it. And in 1949, we saw three notable films on that subject. We had The Sands of Iwo Jima, 12 O'Clock High, and Battleground. All came out in the same year, pretty interesting year. I want to talk first about Battleground. Steve, you wrote that it helped actually jumpstart the genre of combat film. How so?
First of all, it was an MGM title. MGM was producing the biggest and, in many ways, the most successful films of the period. Dori Sherry had just come over from RKO to take over MGM, and Robert Pyrosh was one of their favorite writers, and it was based on his own experiences. Again, we're starting to see true World War II stories based on actual things that happened. And the screenplay won the Oscar that year for Best Screenplay. Robert Pyrosh's story is about the battered bastards of Bastogne who defended in the Battle of the Bulge. And it's a very gritty movie. Now, that said, it is a Hollywood movie in a way that it was filmed almost entirely on sound stages. You know, they recreated the Winter of the Ardennes on these big cavernous MGM sound stages, but just really a beautifully acted film and got a lot of attention. And it seemed to be that the public was ready to accept true World War II stories. The stories that really happened without the propaganda.
Seth, I know this film is close to your heart. What makes Battleground stand out to you, and maybe with a foot in both history, but also as a viewer looking at it for entertainment value? I know this is something that you really value.
Yeah, I'll cut straight to the chase. In my opinion, as a historian, this is probably the most accurate World War II movie ever made. And, you know, people are going to say, what, Saving Private Ryan? No, it isn't. And I'm not talking about the gunshots and the tracers and all the special effects. I'm talking about the way things are done. As Steve was saying, you know, there was a popular writer at the time who was doing this. Perosh was doing this. And, you know, it was based off of an actual historical event. It was based
that
off
he was
of
in, we should point out. He was
correct.
There. Yeah.
Right. And it was based off of, you know, it's set with an actual unit, the 327th Glider Infantry Regiment and the 101st Airborne, who was at Bastogne. A lot of the extras in the movie are real, honest to God, 101st Airborne paratroopers or glidermen. And it adds a sense of realism to, to the movie that, frankly, you just don't get today. I mean, they send the actors to boot camp today, but you didn't have to in 1949 because these guys had already gone for real. And it's just a great movie. You know, they speak in the GI jive. You know, I mean, they do. They use the language and the lingo of the American GI and their attitudes and their, you know, fatalistic attitudes. And, you know, you got the naive recruit coming in, and he's surrounded by these veterans from this hardcore unit. And you know, you see him change, him being Marshall Thompson, change throughout the movie into another grizzled veteran in this unit. And it's just, it's a fantastic movie. You know, I like to say it's a love letter to the American GI and the European theater. And I think that's exactly what it is. And that's what it was meant to be.
To dovetail onto what you were just saying, we actually have another clip to share, this one from Battleground, and it underscores that while we have the 10,000-foot view, you can read a book about the Battle of the Bulge, you can study the maps and the atlases, many times the individual soldiers had no concept about what was going on beyond their immediate environment, and there's a scene from the movie that really shows that. Let's take a listen.
War Department authorities report that morale is high all along the front. Battle-hardened doughboys fresh from epoch-making triumphs.
Skip the commercial, Jarvis.
Air activity was halted by thick, swirling fog. Recognize stabilizer mills. At Bastogne, the 101st Airborne.
Hey, that's us.
Men, you will be proud to know that you are making an heroic stand. Hurling back the best that von Rundstedt can throw at you.
Who's von Rundstedt?
Who's von Rundstedt? They aren't reading the history books. They haven't been written yet. And Seth, I know this is related to what you were just talking about. This is a love letter to the GI, you were saying, and I think that's exactly what Robert Perosh was trying to do here, really illustrate. And by the way, the troops there are reading an issue of Stars and Stripes, trying to figure out what the bigger picture is, and they're still just as lost afterward.
You know, Brandon, when I interviewed Mr. Pyrosh back in 1974, he told me that when he went back to do his research in 1948, he actually found his foxhole in the Ardennes Forest where he had dug it back in 1944. This is a guy who really got the dirt of the war under his fingernails from his own experience. I believe he was 35th Infantry Division, and of course, he later goes on to create the television series Combat, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But Pyrosh also made another one of my favorite World War II movies 13 years later, which is, I think, another great salute to the combat infantrymen, which is Hell is for Heroes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about, as we kind of go through here, we need to leave the 1940s behind because we have a lot more to get to here. Just in a general sense, though, I noticed a common critical observation, just as critics and reviewers and historians look at these films, sometimes a common observation is, well, it didn't include this specific angle, or it condensed the timeline, or they weren't exactly in that right position, and that therefore somehow the film or the TV show is incomplete. But what I wonder is, because by nature a film or a TV show is finite in its time and its scope, is it always inevitable that we're going to have to leave something out? Something's going to have to go on the editing room floor just to tell the story. Right.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's going to have to. I mean, you know, the Battle of the Bulge was the largest battle ever fought by the United States Army before and, you know, since. And there's only so much you can tell. And I forget how long the movie is, you know, 80 some odd minutes. There's only so much you can tell and show. And, you know, you're going to leave parts out and you're not going to be able to get everything. But, you know, I think one aspect about Battleground and Sands of Iwo Jima 2 and 12 O'Clock High, those movies were made for veterans, I think. You know, I think they were made for the guys that came home, and you know, they recognized the things that they were talking about. They recognized the locations and the events, and that was extremely important because they were playing to an audience that wasn't there during World War II because they were overseas.
Yeah, this opens up an interesting question. I want to get both of your opinions on this, and Steve, we can start with you, and Seth to bounce back to you. In the broad sense, there's always going to be an experience gap for the people who were there and the people who were not. And you can never quite, I think, communicate. And I've never served in the armed services, and so I'm speaking from the civilian perspective here, that you're never going to know exactly what it was like, and it's always going to be hard to communicate, no matter how visual, no matter how eloquent a writer you are or what kind of CGI you have under your belt. And I just wonder, is there always going to be that experience gap? And what I'm getting at here is what you just talked about, Seth, but to Steve, to get you to answer this question first off anyway, is... is, can these films help close that experience gap? I mean, are we talking to, should filmmakers be talking to the civilian audience? Are they trying to talk to veterans, or can you try to talk to both?
That's a very, very good question, Brandon. I think that filmmaking has changed dramatically over the years. I think Steven Spielberg is partially responsible for that in terms of going back to the movie Jaws, where you're in the water and you feel like the shark's about to eat you right there. It's translated into World War II movies. And obviously it's Saving Private Ryan, but I think filmmaking is so visceral now. I think Private Ryan kind of set the bar with this free camera and the kind of crazy type of editing going on where you're right in the thick of things, just like in Jaws coming out of the water, in Saving Private Ryan going into the water. Filmmaking is very visceral, and I use that word emphatically because you begin to get in the picture. I mean, you know, I know there's 3D and, you know, all this virtual reality stuff they're talking about, but, you know, the movies today put you in the picture like no one has ever put you in the picture ever in the history of filmmaking. So I think the experience is much more palpable now for your average person watching the movie. And, you know, the great fact is that no one can really ever make a movie that shows the true nature of war. Now, I'm not a combat veteran. I'm not a veteran at all. But from talking to veterans, they could never put that on film because it would be more horrific than the most horrific horror movie.
Mm-hmm. Seth, what do you have to add to that?
I would agree with that. I mean, you can't show true combat. I mean, well, I guess you could, but it would be something that really people don't want to see. But you know, talking about making a movie that speaks to, you know, the veterans and those they left behind back at home, you know, I think the three movies that we just mentioned specifically, though, the two, Battleground and 12 O'Clock High, they both do that. Because, you know, with Battleground and 12 O'Clock High, the veterans are seeing some of the things that they did, some of the things that they saw or heard, and they're relating to it. And then on the flip side of that, you know, they're sitting next to their wives or girlfriends or mothers or whoever, sisters, and they're seeing this stuff, same stuff on screen, and wondering, man, wow, is that why, you know, you don't sleep at night? Is that why you're tossing and turning? Is that the kind of thing you saw? And to which, you know, more often than not, the veteran either wouldn't answer or say, that's not even close, but you might get an idea. And I do think it's very important that movies do that, and those two in particular do it very well.
I was once I was once sitting across a craft service table with Charles Durning, you know, the portly actor, wonderful character actor, he's been in a million things. I'm discovering that he was a ranger at Point du Hoc on D-Day. I mean, this little portly man was one of these guys who had to climb that cliff. And this, we actually were able to get a little bit out of him. I mean, he got into a hand-to-hand combat fight with a guy, got stabbed in the throat, somehow survived that. He ended up becoming one of the guys who has to identify the victims of the Malmedy massacre in the Battle of the Bulge. I mean, talk about one of the worst duties to have to perform. And the stories he told, you know, were so horrific, and you can't really tell them, although there have been touches of that now. And I'll point back to Saving Private Ryan. It seemed to point back to that movie a lot. I mean, the sequence where Adam Goldberg is in hand-to-hand combat with a German, you know, Waffen-SS soldier is just horrific. And it was even more horrific before they cut it down. The fight between Goldberg and that German was just nine-tenths more devastating. They had to cut it way, way back. People could not stomach it.
Mm-hmm. I imagine that would probably be true. I think that may be like the unbreakable, like, light speed barrier, we might say, for these kinds of films is being maybe too visceral. We get an impression then that, you know, war movies have become a lot bloodier, and you can see the limbs being blown off and people shot through the head and all that, and that may give you a better visual impression. But I think what we're talking about here is it really doesn't close what I'm calling that experience gap, does it?
No, I don't think it does. I mean, you can see it on screen, but it's one thing to see it on screen. It's another thing to experience it. And you know,
we have a volunteer army now. I mean, basically, you know, most Americans are not in the military. The people who are in the military want to be there, and it's their experience. It's hard for us to identify with it unless you've studied it like Seth and I have. I mean, we're probably closer than most people, but, you know, it's interesting. Most people don't think about war every day. They really, really don't. They think about paying their bills, going to the supermarket, but it's you know, for those guys, I don't think they ever forget it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's perfectly understandable. I want to jump ahead to the 1960s as we go forward in time. And here we get into a kind of a resurgence. We had kind of a high water mark for particularly television series. While Hollywood had been turning out films about the war, as we've talked about, during and after, television was a little later getting there. We had some documentaries like Victory at Sea that aired in the 1950s on NBC. But in terms of turning war stories into entertainment, episodic, serialized storytelling. That was really kind of an invention of the 1960s. And Steve, we can get to your area here, the TV series Combat, which you alluded to a little earlier, created by Robert Peroche, who name sounds familiar, of course, because he wrote Battleground. He came back to produce this show for television, to develop this for ABC in 1961. It went on the air in 62. Stayed on the air for 5 years. It is the story of, and sounds familiar because it's Robert Peroche's DNA here, the small group of soldiers, no higher rank than a lieutenant, as they have this kind of bug's eye view of the post-Normandy push through France in World War II in 1944 and 45. Steve, you've watched a lot of this. You've studied the program. What made Combat special? Why is it? And I've noticed it's been really well regarded and very well thought of by the people who grew up watching it. Why is that?
Well, I think that Vic Morrow's performance as Sergeant Saunders was so extraordinary. He anchored that show, and he was not as strong in the first few episodes. The show, even though Robert Peroche created the series, he really only wrote the pilot. I think you'd have to talk about Robert Altman, the great filmmaker who produced the first season, and I think got involved heavily in the story writing. The stories were very strong. I think they were identifiable to most people. This is an opportunity each week to see an infantry unit fighting in France. I think that was interesting, something different. Ironically, this movie reached its popularity as the war in Vietnam was starting to heat up, and I think it speaks to its effectiveness, the fact that even during the anti-war period of the Vietnam War, Combat was very popular, and actually I think episodes were run for soldiers in Vietnam. So the stories, the casting, great cast, great characters, solid writing for 5 years, that contributed to its success.
We'll pause right here for another station break. When we return, our discussion continues. You were just listening to Steve Rubin. We have Seth Paradin from New Orleans as well. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. You're listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. Dialogue now continues. Our topic today, World War II on the big screen and the small screen. I'm joined today by Seth Paradin. He's an historian with the National World War II Museum and host of the podcast Service on Celluloid. He's joining us from NPR member station WWNO in New Orleans. And Steve Rubin is on the phone from Southern California. He's the author of the book Combat Films, American Realism, 1945 to 2010. I want to stick in the 1960s for just a moment. We were talking about Combat, and this seemed to be the program that launched a lot of other similar programs on all of the then three extant broadcast TV networks, ABC, NBC, CBS. And just to make sure I wasn't making this up or imagining it, I looked at the primetime schedules for those three networks. In the 1965-66 TV season, just that one season, there were seven episodic series that had something to do with World War II. Some of them, like Combat, were directly related to and told those stories. Others kind of used it as a backdrop, like a McHale's Navy, which was comedy, obviously, but set in the war. Four of them were comedy series, three of them were dramas, and aired across all the networks. And Steve, my question buried in all of this is, why do you think that happened, that there was this kind of high watermark where suddenly we got a glut? I guess maybe, if I may posit, that television tends to go through fads like that. Like in the 1950s, it was Westerns. In the 60s, it was war shows. Is that right?
I don't think so. I don't think World War II was ever huge. I think that there were some successful shows. The same year that Combat came on, another show came on a rival network called Gallant Men, which did not do well. 12 O'Clock High was a very good series produced by Quinn Martin. I thought it was well done. The Rat Patrol was a little bit of a cartoon in a way. I mean, two guys in Jeeps defeating the Africa Corps was a little bit much. I think that they were not a genre. I think they were successful shows for a while. And I think as the Vietnam War heats up in 68, 69, they began to disappear. Combat went off the air in 67, were replaced by Garrison's Guerrillas, which I think lasted just one or two seasons.
It's just one season, yeah.
Yeah, I just I think that World War II has been a little bit of a difficult fit for television, with a few exceptions. I think, you know, it's really funny in a lot of ways. Can you sell toothpaste and toilet paper while showing World War II? I think the sponsors preferred lighter fare, and I think, or you know, the staples, doctor shows, lawyer shows, cop shows, and I think it's been tough. I mean, believe me, I've tried to get World War II things going on television. Challenging.
Yeah. And actually, that it is disproportionate, right? Because when we think about, say, recent productions like Saving Private Ryan, but Band of Brothers and The Pacific, those were HBO miniseries, obviously cinematic, obviously shot and treated like films, but they were episodic television, at least miniseries, a rarity. We don't usually see, and I think one in the 1980s called War and Remembrance, but we generally do not see World War II at least widely depicted on television. Is that right?
Well, I have an opinion about that. I think it's really the responsibility of the filmmaker or the producer. And just like with Westerns, the great Western filmmakers are gone. You know, the guys who wrote the great Westerns, the John Fords of the world are gone. I think a lot of the people who are so steeped in World War II history, who had parents and grandparents who fought in the war, I think those people are not really producing much in TV, or they're simply not focused in that area. I think it takes, just with movies, it takes a certain kind of filmmaker to get it going, get the juices flowing. You take Steven Spielberg away from some of these equations, and maybe Band of Brothers doesn't get made. Maybe Saving Private Ryan would not have been made. I think that you really have to have a top filmmaker. Now, Michael Bay, a very, very successful filmmaker with his Transformer movies. I think he had enough clout to get Pearl Harbor made. I don't think Pearl Harbor gets made without Michael Bay. And then we have this movie Midway coming up, again, from the director of Independence Day. So it takes a big filmmaker with a lot of Hollywood clout, because these suits who sit around their desks and decide what Hollywood makes, these so-called bean counters, they don't like passion. They don't like creativity. They like hard, fast numbers. What's it going to do? We spend $200 million on Spider-Man 12, it'll make $1.2 billion. It sounds like a plan. It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, and that gets back to something actually we talked about a little earlier in this discussion about just the difficulty of telling a war story in a way that doesn't turn off any of its intended audience, right? And still, of course, has to be to some degree, the studio wants to make money. So I think that's an excellent point. I wanted to ask, to get back to that experience gap question or something related to it, kind of a cousin of that question, do we know much about how veterans react when watching these films? And I'm remembering, if I remember this correctly, Robert Leckie, who is depicted, he was a Marine in the Pacific Theater, was depicted in the series The Pacific and wrote the acclaimed memoir Helmet for My Pillow, supposedly walked out of a production of South Pacific. He's like, hey, but this is not what I went through. I'm leaving. I'm not doing this anymore. I mean, do we know much about how veterans view these films?
It depends. You know, if you're talking about the two miniseries you just mentioned, Band of Brothers and The Pacific, they were met with very high regard by the men who were in those units. So the Band of Brothers would have been Easy Company 506, 101st. You know, those, first of all, that miniseries made those guys stars, and then, you know, they liked that. But it was a pretty accurate representation of their experience. And the guys who were portrayed in the Pacific, or at least their units were, which would have been Leckie's Company, H Company, 2nd Battalion, 1st, and the 1st Marine Division, and then Eugene Sledge, K Company, 3rd Battalion, 5th. Those guys, especially the Pacific, were very, very keen on the production because they did think that it told their story very well. And, you know, there are drastic differences between Band of Brothers and the Pacific. You know, the Pacific is much more visceral.
Mm-hmm.
That's a term we've used here, you know, repeatedly in this hour. But it's much grittier. It's dirtier. You feel it more. You know, it's much more intense than Band of Brothers, and because the Pacific War was completely different than the European theater, it was a totally different war. And
you know, Seth, when I watched that miniseries, I had no idea how hellish the conditions were. I mean, you know, talk about sanitized World War II movies. Pacific Theater movies have a tendency to not be that gritty, at least up until Saw of the Pacific. But
right.
You're absolutely right. I mean, you're in Europe. There's houses. There's civilians. It seems like somewhat like our world. You get to an island like Peleliu. Oh my God! No water. You're fighting a war with no water. I mean, it.
And an enemy you can't see.
Yeah.
It was a horrible, horrible thing, and it was drastically different. And there's a scene in, I think it's episode 10 of The Pacific, where Lecky, or his character rather, is dropped off at his house by a cab driver. And the cab driver is, I think he's 101st Airborne veteran, or maybe 82nd, I don't recall, but he's a European theater veteran. And Lecky gets out to pay for the fare, and the driver, Lecky's in his Marine Corps uniform, and the driver says, "Nah, this one's on me. I'm not taking it." He says, "At least, in Europe, we could go to Paris and we could go to London." He says, "In the Pacific, you guys didn't have anything." And it's very true. Mm. When they were overseas, that was it.
Yeah, I want to, as we're talking about this, I think, Seth, you're of the opinion that the Pacific also gets into some different areas in terms of its characters. For instance, it depicts PTSD in a way that Band of Brothers really didn't.
It does. There's only one or two instances in Band of Brothers where it shows men suffering with, traumatic experiences. But the Pacific, it's the whole program, from episode 1 to episode 10. And there's a scene, again, it's in episode 10, that I think is beautiful, and by beautiful, it's extremely poignant. And it's Gene Sledge is going off to shoot birds, quail or something with his father.
Mm-hmm.
And he's getting out of the truck, and you can tell, he's extremely reluctant. He's carrying a weapon, he's carrying a shotgun, and he's just, he wants to be there to experience this with his dad, but the last thing on earth he wants to do is point a weapon at something and kill it again. And he reluctantly gets out of the vehicle and he follows his dad down the fence line, and then he just stops and he breaks down and he just, literally collapses there in the middle of the trail and starts sobbing. And his father, who was not a combat veteran, but he treated veterans of World War I,
mm-hmm.
and he knew the psychological issues that they had suffered, instantly recognized what his son was going through. And it's absolutely beautiful because his father knows what's happening and he goes to comfort his boy. All of a sudden he's no longer a man, it's his little boy again. And it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful.
This takes me to my very next question. This one's for both of you. And Steve, we can start with you. What makes these films and these television shows worthwhile? And I want to distinguish that from, say, entertaining or historical necessarily, because there are different metrics you can use to measure all these films. But what exactly is it that sets in your mind the best of the best, apart from sort of the middling or the cruddy?
Well, my overall arching feeling about this is that how it makes me feel about my country. I mean, America's the greatest country on earth, and when I see a World War II movie where we're kicking the hell out of the Germans or the Japanese, it makes me feel good. And I think that that is where I would like to be most of the time. I think that points out to the reason there are 1,700 World War II movies. I mean, the public really wants to see why we fight, how we fight, and how we kick ass. And I think that overall feeling comes from the best of the best. I think that, as Seth points out, it's hard to watch The Pacific at times because we're getting the hell kicked out of us. And basically, it's hard to watch. And we're not doing very well. Eventually, we do triumph, of course, as we do. But my overall feeling is that the best of the best movies make us feel good about us as Americans.
And Seth, what is your metric when you talk about the films that you value the most? What are those common characteristics?
Well, it's similar to what Steve says, but it's also very different. And that, in my role at the museum, I've been with the World War II Museum as a historian for 15 years now, and I've interviewed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of World War II veterans for our archives and our oral history program. So I came to know these people very, very well. Many of them, a great many of them, were my very close friends, and for me, when I was a kid watching World War II movies, it was all about the shooting and the guns and the tanks and the ships and the planes and everything, as most 10, 12-year-old boys are, want to do. But as I got older, and especially after I got to know these people, a good World War II movie, or a good war movie, period, but especially a World War II movie, it tells the actual story of the men, not necessarily of an event, not necessarily, you know, battleground and talking about Battle of the Bulge. You know, I can read a book about that. But it tells the story of the guys and what they went through, or it tries. And that's why I think Battleground, 12 O'Clock High, Sands of Iwo Jima, the Pacific are so vitally important. Best years of our lives. Unbroken, the second one, not the first one, the second one, when it deals with Zamperini's post-traumatic stress, it is something that's, you know, vital for people to understand what war is about. And it's not just guns and shooting and killing. And it's not just, you know, killing the enemy. It's killing a little bit of your soul, too. And that I find that to be incredibly important, just as important as it was in 46. It's more important today with the current conflict and the experiences that our veterans are currently going through today. And a good war movie expresses those feelings, and it shows those reactions, sometimes in a visceral way, but other times it has to be accurate, and you know, a great many of them do. And when that happens, that's a good movie to me.
We had a question come in from one of our listeners. Do we know much about how, or could we talk a little bit about how other countries involved in the war have handled this genre as well? Do the films and TV shows that are produced in, say, Britain or Italy or Germany or Japan that talk about World War II, do they follow similar contours as American productions, or are there unique elements that are, of course, based on their unique experiences? And maybe, Seth, you could chime in on that.
Sure. The movies that are made in Russia, or, you know, at one time the Soviet Union, they're very, very triumphant, you know, because, I mean, they're fighting the Germans, and you know, the Russians call it the Great Patriotic War. And they did then, they do now. And, you know, they're always winning. and of course, they didn't always win.
No, that was pretty arduous, I mean, to say the very least, for Russia for many years.
That's an understatement.
But yeah.
So their movies are very triumphant. They generally make the Germans out to look like clowns, and you know, their soldiers are, you know, soldiers of virtue, and that's another conversation for another time. And you contrast that with the German pictures that are made, have been made, and continue to be made. And they it's odd because a lot of times they villainize their own people. There's obvious reasons for that. I mean, let's be real. You know, Germany wasn't exactly a virtue. They weren't a pillar of virtue during World War II, God knows. But, there was a miniseries made, and by many, I mean it was three episodes, I believe, made not long ago. The English translation is Our Fathers, Our Mothers, and it's they call it the German Band of Brothers, if you will, and it focuses on three or four guys and a female and their experiences during World War II on the Eastern Front. And it's one of the only that I know of, aside from Das Boot, one of the only German-produced productions that doesn't villainize their people, that tries to show exactly, as close as they can, what these men and women went through. And it's very, very good. I highly recommend it. It's a really good series. And, each country has their own view of it. Britain's view of World War II is very similar to ours. They focus on the triumphs and some of the tragedies as well, but their production is similar to ours.
Okay, well, we're coming up to the end of our hour, so I want to get a couple of recommendations from the two of you. And Steve, we can begin with you. Films or TV series that we have not already discussed that you think are worth our listeners checking out. Steve, what do you think?
Well, my desert island movie, which of course probably most of your listeners have seen many times, is John Sturges' The Great Escape. It's the first World War II movie I saw as a kid that made me start to study the war from many levels. And, of course, the early 1960s is the time of The Longest Day. And later on, films like Where Eagles Dare, Kelly's Heroes. This is the era of the big epic World War II movies. So I would say The Great Escape should be on everybody's list. But there are a couple movies that don't get a lot of attention, and since you just mentioned foreign films, if anyone has ever seen, should see, the Dutch film Soldier of Orange with Rutger Hauer and Haroon Krabbe. That is a marvelous World War II movie set in Holland. I highly recommend that. I mentioned the aforementioned the Steve McQueen film Hell is for Heroes from director Don Siegel.
Let me cut you off right there. Could I do that? And just, Seth, if you could give us maybe one film. I'm sorry, we're out of time.
Sure. No problem. Stalag 17. Got to see Stalag 17, Otto Preminger. Fantastic movie.
I'll put it on my list. Thank you to Seth Paradin of the National World War II Museum, to Steve Rubin in Southern California, and the staff of WWNO in New Orleans who made today's connection possible. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. The producer is Greg Hill. Thank you for listening to Dialogue.